Eh? He asked his wife, looking past her. Prince Hippolyte hurriedly put on his cloak, which in the latest fashion reached to his very heels, and stumbling in it, ran out into the porch, following the princess, whom a footman was helping into the carriage.
Princess, au revoir, cried he, stumbling with his tongue as well as with his feet.
The princess, picking up her dress, was taking her seat in the dark carriage. Her husband was adjusting his sabre. Prince Hippolyte, under pretence of helping, was in everyone's way.
"Allow me, sir," said Prince Andrei, in Russian, in a cold, disagreeable tone, to Prince Hippolyte, who was blocking his path.
"I am expecting you, Pierre," said the same voice, but gently and affectionately. The postillion started. The carriage wheels rattled. Prince Hippolyte laughed spasmodically as he stood in the porch, waiting for the Vicomte, whom he had promised to take home.
"Well, mon cher," said the Vicomte, having seated himself beside Hippolyte in the carriage, "your little princess is very nice indeed, quite French." And he kissed the tips of his fingers. Hippolyte burst out laughing. "Do you know you are a terrible chap for all your innocent airs?" continued the Vicomte. "I pity the poor husband, that little officer who gives himself the airs of a monarch." Hippolyte spluttered again, and amid his laughter said,
"And you were saying that the Russian ladies are not equal to the French? Ha ha! One has to know how to deal with them."
Pierre, reaching the house first, went into Prince Andrei's study, like one quite at home, and from habit immediately lay down on the sofa, took from the shelf the first book that came to his hand, it was Caesar's Commentaries, and resting on his elbow, began reading it in the middle.
"What have you done to Mademoiselle Scherer? She will be quite ill now," said Prince Andrei as he entered the study, rubbing his small white hands.
Pierre turned his whole body, making the sofa creak. He lifted his eager face to Prince Andrei, smiled, and waved his hand.
"That abbé is very interesting, but he does not see things in the right light. In my opinion, perpetual peace is possible, but I don't know how to express it, not by a balance of political power."
It was evident that Prince Andrei was not interested in such abstract conversation.
"One can't everywhere say all one thinks, mon cher.
Well, have you at last decided on anything? Are you going to be a guardsman or a diplomatist?" asked Prince Andrei after a momentary silence.
Pierre sat up on the sofa with his legs tucked under him.
"Really, I don't know yet. I don't like either the one or the other."
"But you must decide on something. Your father expects it."
Pierre, at the age of 10, had been sent abroad with an abbé as tutor, and had remained away till he was 20. When he returned to Moscow, his father dismissed the abbé and said to the young man, "Now go to Petersburg, look round and choose your profession. I will agree to anything. Here is a letter to Prince Vasily, and here is money. Write to me all about it, and I will help you in everything." Pierre had already been choosing a career for 3 months and had not decided on anything. It was about this choice that Prince Andrei was speaking. Pierre rubbed his forehead.
"But he must be a Freemason," said he, referring to the abbé
whom he had met that evening.
"That is all nonsense," Prince Andrei again interrupted him. "Let us talk business. Have you been to the Horse Guards?"
"No, I have not. But this is what I've been thinking and wanted to tell you. There is a war now against Napoleon. If it were a war for freedom, I could understand it and should be the first to enter the army. But to help England and Austria against the greatest man in the world is not right."
Prince Andrei only shrugged his shoulders at Pierre's childish words. He put on the air of one who finds it impossible to reply to such nonsense, but it would, in fact, have been difficult to give any other answer than the one Prince Andrei gave to this naive question. "If no one fought except on his own conviction, there would be no wars," he said.
"And that would be splendid," said Pierre.
Prince Andrei smiled ironically.
"Very likely it would be splendid, but it will never come about.
"Well, why are you going to the war?" asked Pierre.
"What for? I don't know. I must. Besides that, I'm going..." He paused. "I'm going because the life I'm leading here does not suit me."
Chapter 7. The rustle of a woman's dress was heard in the next room. Prince Andrei shook himself as if waking up, and his face assumed the look it had had in Anna Pavlovna's drawing room. Pierre removed his feet from the sofa. The princess came in. She had changed her gown for a house dress as fresh and elegant as the other. Prince Andrei rose and politely placed a chair for her.
"How is it?" she began as usual in French, settling down briskly and fussily in the easy chair. "How is it Annette never got married? How stupid you men all are not to have married her! Excuse me for saying so, but you have no sense about women. What an argumentative fellow you are, Monsieur Pierre!"
"And I'm still arguing with your husband. I can't understand why he wants to go to the war," replied Pierre, addressing the princess with none of the embarrassment so commonly shown by young men in their intercourse with young women. The princess started. Evidently Pierre's words touched her to the quick.
"Ah, that is just what I tell him," said she. "I don't understand it. I don't in the least understand why men can't live without wars. How is it that we women don't want anything of the kind, don't need it? Now, you shall judge between us. I always tell him, here he is, uncle's aide-de-camp, a most brilliant position. He is so well known, so much appreciated by everyone. The other day at the Apraxins I heard a lady asking, 'Is that the famous Prince Andrei?' I did indeed," she laughed. "He is so well received everywhere. He might easily become aide-de-camp to the Emperor. You know, the Emperor spoke to him most graciously. Annette and I were speaking of how to arrange it. What do you think?"
Pierre looked at his friend and, noticing that he did not like the conversation, gave no reply.
"When are you starting?" he asked.
"Oh, don't speak of his going, don't. I won't hear it spoken of," said the princess, in the same petulantly playful tone in which she had spoken to Hippolyte in the drawing-room, and which was so plainly ill-suited to the family circle of which Pierre was almost a member. "Today, when I remembered that all these delightful associations must be broken off. And then you know, André," she looked significantly at her husband, I'm afraid," she whispered, and a shudder ran down her back.
Her husband looked at her as if surprised to notice that someone besides Pierre and himself was in the room, and addressed her in a tone of frigid politeness.
"What is it you're afraid of, Lisa? I don't understand," said he.
"There, what egotists men all are, all egotists. Just for a whim of his own, goodness only knows why, he leaves me and locks me up alone in the country."
"With my father and sister, remember," said Prince Andrei gently.
"Alone all the same, without my friends, and he expects me not to be afraid."
Her tone was now querulous and her lip drawn up, giving her not a joyful but an animal squirrel-like expression. She paused as if she felt it indecorous to speak of her pregnancy before Pierre, though the gist of the matter lay in that.
"I still can't understand what you are afraid of," said Prince Andrei slowly, not taking his eyes off his wife. The princess blushed and raised her arms with a gesture of despair.
"No, Andrei, I must say you have changed. Oh, how you have—"
"Your doctor tells you to go to bed earlier," said Prince Andrei. "You had better go."
The princess said nothing, but suddenly her short, downy lip quivered. Prince Andrei rose, shrugged his shoulders, and walked about the room. Pierre looked over his spectacles with naive surprise, now at him and now at her, moved as if about to rise too, but changed his mind.
"Why should I mind Monsieur Pierre being here?" exclaimed the little princess suddenly, her pretty face all at once distorted by a tearful grimace. "I have long wanted to ask you, André, why you have changed so to me. What have I done to you? You are going to the war and have no pity for me. Why is it?"
"Lisa?" was all Prince Andrei said. But that one word expressed an entreaty, a threat, and above all, conviction that she would herself regret her words. But she went on hurriedly. "You treat me like an invalid or a child. I see it all. Did you behave like that 6 months ago?"
"Lisa, I beg you to desist," said Prince Andrei still more emphatically.
Pierre, who had been growing more and more agitated as he listened to all this, rose and approached the princess. He seemed unable to bear the sight of tears and was ready to cry himself.
"Calm yourself, princess. It seems so to you because I assure you I myself have experienced an outsider is out of place here. No, don't distress yourself. Goodbye."
Prince Andrei caught him by the hand. "No, wait, Pierre. The princess is too kind to wish to deprive me of the pleasure of spending the evening with you."
"No, he thinks only of himself," muttered the princess without restraining her angry tears.
"Lisa," said Prince Andrei dryly, raising his voice to the pitch which indicates that patience is exhausted.
Suddenly, the angry, squirrel-like expression of the princess's pretty face changed into a winning and piteous look of fear. Her beautiful eyes glanced askance at her husband's face, and her own assumed the timid, deprecating expression of a dog when it rapidly but feebly wags its drooping tail.
"Mon Dieu, mon Dieu,"
she muttered, and lifting her dress with one hand, she went up to her husband and kissed him on the forehead. "Good night, Lisa," said he, rising and courteously kissing her hand, as he would have done to a stranger.
Chapter 8. The friends were silent. Neither cared to begin talking. Pierre continually glanced at Prince Andrei. Prince Andrei rubbed his forehead with his small hand.
"Let us go and have supper," he said with a sigh, going to the door.
They entered the elegant, newly decorated and luxurious dining room. Everything from the table napkins to the silver, china, and glass bore that imprint of newness found in the households of the newly married. Halfway through supper, Prince Andrei leaned his elbows on the table, and with a look of nervous agitation such as Pierre had never before seen on his face, began to talk as one who has long had something on his mind and suddenly determines to speak out.
"Never, never marry, my dear fellow. That's my advice. Never marry till you can say to yourself that you've done all you're capable of, and until you have ceased to love the woman of your choice and have seen her plainly as she is, or else you will make a cruel and irrevocable mistake. Marry when you are old and good for nothing, or all that is good and noble in you will be lost. It will all be wasted on trifles. Yes, yes, yes. Don't look at me with such surprise. If you marry expecting anything from yourself in the future, you will feel at every step that for you all is ended, all is closed except the drawing room, where you will be ranged side by side with a court lackey and an idiot. But what's the good?" And he waved his arm.
Pierre took off his spectacles, which made his face seem different and the good-natured expression still more apparent, and gazed at his friend in amazement.
"My wife," continued Prince Andrei, "is an excellent woman, one of those rare women with whom a man's honour is safe. But, oh God, what would I not give now to be unmarried? You are the first and only one to whom I mention this because I like you."
As he said this, Prince Andrei was less than ever like that Bolkonski who had lolled in Anna Pavlovna's easy chairs and with half-closed eyes had uttered French phrases between his teeth. Every muscle of his thin face was now quivering with nervous excitement. His eyes, in which the fire of life had seemed extinguished, now flashed with brilliant light. It was evident that the more lifeless he seemed at ordinary times, the more impassioned he became in these moments of almost morbid irritation.
"You don't understand why I say this," he continued, "but it is the whole story of life. You talk of Bonaparte and his career," said he. though Pierre had not mentioned Bonaparte. But Bonaparte, when he worked, went step by step towards his goal. He was free. He had nothing but his aim to consider, and he reached it. But tie yourself up with a woman, and like a chained convict you lose all freedom, and all you have of hope and strength merely weighs you down and torments you with regret. Drawing-rooms, gossip, balls, vanity and triviality, these are the enchanted circle I cannot escape from. I am now going to the war, the greatest war there ever was, and I know nothing and am fit for nothing. I am very amiable and have a caustic wit, continued Prince Andrei, and at Anna Pavlovna's they listen to me, and that stupid set without whom my wife cannot exist, and those women. If you only knew what those society women are, and women in general. My father is right. Selfish, vain, stupid, trivial in everything. That's what women are when you see them in their true colours. When you meet them in society, it seems as if there was something in them, but there's nothing, nothing, nothing. No, don't marry, my dear fellow. Don't marry, concluded Prince Andrei.
It seems funny to me, said Pierre, that you should consider yourself incapable and your life a spoiled life. You have everything before you, everything. And you...
He did not finish his sentence, but his tone showed how highly he thought of his friend and how much he expected of him in the future.
How can he talk like that? Thought Pierre.
He considered his friend a model of perfection, because Prince Andrei possessed in the highest degree just the very qualities Pierre lacked, and which might be best described as strength of will. Pierre was always astonished at Prince Andrei's calm manner of treating everybody, his extraordinary memory, his extensive reading. He had read everything, knew everything, and had an opinion about everything, but above all, at his capacity for work and study. And if Pierre was often struck by Andrei's lack of capacity for philosophical meditation, to which he himself was particularly addicted, he regarded even this not as a defect, but as a sign of strength. Even in the best, most friendly, and simplest relations of life, praise and commendation are essential, just as grease is necessary to wheels that they may run smoothly.
My part is played out, said Prince Andrei. What's the use of talking about me? Let us talk about you, he added after a silence, smiling at his reassuring thoughts. That smile was immediately reflected on Pierre's face.
But what is there to say about me? Said Pierre, his face relaxing into a careless, merry smile. What am I? An illegitimate son.
He suddenly blushed crimson, and it was plain that he had made a great effort to say this.
Without a name and without means, and it really...
But he did not say what it really was.
For the present, I'm free and I'm all right, only I haven't the least idea what I am to do. I wanted to consult you seriously.
Prince Andrei looked kindly at him, yet his glance, friendly and affectionate as it was, expressed a sense of his own superiority.
I am fond of you, especially as you are the one live man among our whole set.
Yes, yes, you're all right. Choose what you will, it's all the same. You'll be all right anywhere. But look here, give up visiting those Kuragins and leading that sort of life. It suits you so badly, all this debauchery, dissipation and the rest of it.
What would you have, my dear fellow? Answered Pierre, shrugging his shoulders. Women, my dear fellow, women.
I don't understand it, replied Prince Andrei. Women who are comme il faut, that's a different matter. But the Kuragin set of women, women and wine, I don't understand.
Pierre was staying at Prince Vasily Kuragin's and sharing the dissipated life of his son Anatole, the son whom they were planning to reform by marrying him to Prince Andrei's sister.
Do you know, said Pierre, as if suddenly struck by a happy thought. Seriously, I've long been thinking of it. Leading such a life, I can't decide or think properly about anything. One's head aches and one spends all one's money. He asked me for tonight, but I won't go.
You give me your word of honour not to go?
on my honour.
Chapter 9. Pierre at Anatole Kuragin's. Dolokhov's bet. It was past 1 o'clock when Pierre left his friend. It was a cloudless, northern summer night. Pierre took an open cab, intending to drive straight home. But the nearer he drew to the house, the more he felt the impossibility of going to sleep on such a night. It was light enough to see a long way in the deserted street, and it seemed more like morning or evening than night. On the way, Pierre remembered that Anatole Kuragin was expecting the usual set for cards that evening, after which there was generally a drinking bout, finishing with visits of a kind Pierre was very fond of. "I should like to go to Kuragin's," thought he. But he immediately recalled his promise to Prince Andrei not to go there. Then, as happens to people of weak character, he desired so passionately once more to enjoy that dissipation he was so accustomed to, that he decided to go. The thought immediately occurred to him that his promise to Prince Andrei was of no account, because before he gave it he had already promised Prince Anatole to come to his gathering. Besides, thought he, all such words of honour are conventional things, with no definite meaning, especially if one considers that by tomorrow one may be dead, or something so extraordinary may happen to one that honour and dishonour will all be the same. Pierre often indulged in reflections of this sort, nullifying all his decisions and intentions. He went to Kuragin's. Reaching the large house near the Horse Guards barracks in which Anatole lived, Pierre entered the lighted porch, ascended the stairs, and went in at the open door. There was no one in the anteroom. Empty bottles, cloaks, and overshoes were lying about. There was a smell of alcohol and sounds of voices and shouting in the distance. Cards and supper were over, but the visitors had not yet dispersed. Pierre threw off his cloak and entered the first room, in which were the remains of supper. A footman, thinking no one saw him, was drinking on the sly what was left in the glasses. From the third room came sounds of laughter, the shouting of familiar voices, the growling of a bear, and general commotion. Some 8 or 9 young men were crowding anxiously round an open window. 3 others were romping with a young bear, one pulling him by the chain and trying to set him at the others. "I bet 100 on Stevens," shouted one. "Mind, no holding on," cried another. "I bet on Dolokhov," cried a third. "Kuragin, you part our hands." "There, leave Bruin alone. Here's a bet on it. At 1 draft, or he loses," shouted a fourth. "Jacob, bring a bottle," shouted the host, a tall, handsome fellow who stood in the midst of the group without a coat and with his fine linen shirt unfastened in front. "Wait a bit, you fellows. Here's Petya. Good man," cried he, addressing Pierre. Another voice, from a man of medium height with clear blue eyes, particularly striking among all these drunken voices by its sober ring, cried from the window, "Come here! Part the bets!" This was Dolokhov, an officer of the Semyonov regiment, a notorious gambler and duelist who was living with Anatole. Pierre smiled, looking about him merrily. "I don't understand. What's it all about?"
"Wait a bit, he's not drunk yet. A bottle here," said Anatole, taking a glass from the table. He went up to Pierre. "First of all, you must drink."
Pierre drank one glass after another, looking from under his brows at the tipsy guests who were again crowding round the window and listening to their chatter. Anatole kept on refilling Pierre's glass while explaining that Dolokhov was betting with Stevens, an English naval officer, that he would drink a bottle of rum sitting on the outer ledge of the third floor window with his legs hanging out.
"Go on, you must drink it all," said Anatole, giving Pierre the last glass, "or I won't let you go."
"No, I won't," said Pierre, pushing Anatole aside, and he went up to the window. Dolokhov was holding the Englishman's hand and clearly and distinctly repeating the terms of the bet, addressing himself particularly to Anatole and Pierre. Dolokhov was of medium height, with curly hair and light blue eyes. He was about 25.
Like all infantry officers, he wore no moustache, so that his mouth, the most striking feature of his face, was clearly seen. The lines of that mouth were remarkably finely curved. The middle of the upper lip formed a sharp wedge and closed firmly on the firm lower one, and something like two distinct smiles played continually round the two corners of the mouth. This, together with the resolute, insolent intelligence of his eyes, produced an effect which made it impossible not to notice his face. Dolokhov was a man of small means and no connections. Yet, though Anatole spent tens of thousands of roubles, Dolokhov lived with him and had placed himself on such a footing that all who knew them, including Anatole himself, respected him more than they did Anatole. Dolokhov could play all games and nearly always won. However much he drank, he never lost his clear-headedness. Both Kuragin and Dolokhov were at that time notorious among the rakes and scapegraces of Petersburg. The bottle of rum was brought. The window frame, which prevented anyone from sitting on the outer sill, was being forced out by two footmen who were evidently flurried and intimidated by the directions and shouts of the gentlemen around. Anatole, with his swaggering air, strode up to the window. He wanted to smash something. Pushing away the footman, he tugged at the frame but couldn't move it. He smashed a pane. "You have a try, Hercules," said he, turning to Pierre. Pierre seized the crossbeam, tugged, and wrenched the oak frame out with a crash. "Take it right out, or they'll think I'm holding on," said Dolokhov. "Is the Englishman bragging, eh? Is it all right?" said Anatole. "First rate," said Pierre, looking at Dolokhov, who with a bottle of rum in his hand was approaching the window, from which the light of the sky, the dawn merging with the afterglow of sunset, was visible. Dolokhov, the bottle of rum still in his hand, jumped onto the windowsill. "Listen!" cried he, standing there and addressing those in the room. All were silent. "I bet 50 imperials," he spoke French, that the Englishman might understand him, but he did not speak it very well. "I bet 50 imperials, or do you wish to make it 100? Added he, addressing the Englishman. "No, 50," replied the latter. "All right, 50 imperials, that I will drink a whole bottle of rum without taking it from my mouth, sitting outside the window on this spot." He stooped and pointed to the sloping ledge outside the window. "And without holding on to anything, is that right?" "Quite right," said the Englishman. Anatole turned to the Englishman, and taking him by one of the buttons of his coat and looking down at him, the Englishman was short, began repeating the terms of the wager to him in English. "Wait!" cried Dolokhov, hammering with the bottle on the windowsill to attract attention. "Wait a bit, Kuragin. Listen. If anyone else does the same, I will pay him 100 imperials. Do you understand?" The Englishman nodded, but gave no indication whether he intended to accept this challenge or not. Anatole did not release him, and though he kept nodding to show that he understood, Anatole went on translating Dolokhov's words into English. A thin young lad, an hussar of the lifeguards who had been losing that evening, climbed on the window-sill, leaned over, and looked down. "Oh, oh, oh," he muttered, looking down from the window at the stones of the pavement. "Shut up," cried Dolokhov, pushing him away from the window. The lad jumped awkwardly back into the room, tripping over his spurs. Placing the bottle on the window-sill, where he could reach it easily, Dolokhov climbed carefully and slowly through the window and lowered his legs. Pressing against both sides of the window, he adjusted himself on his seat, lowered his hands, moved a little to the right and then to the left, and took up the bottle. Anatole brought two candles and placed them on the windowsill, though it was already quite light. Dolokhov's back in his white shirt and his curly head were lit up from both sides. Everyone crowded to the window, the Englishman in front. Pierre stood smiling but silent. One man, older than the others present, suddenly pushed forward with a scared and angry look and wanted to seize hold of Dolokhov's shirt.
"I say, this is folly, he'll be killed," said this more sensible man.
Anatole stopped him.
"Don't touch him, you'll startle him, and then he'll be killed, eh? What then, eh?"
Dolokhov turned around, and again, holding on with both hands, arranged himself on his seat.
"If anyone comes meddling again," said he, emitting the words separately through his thin, compressed lips, "I will throw him down there. Now then."
Saying this, he again turned round, dropped his hands, took the bottle and lifted it to his lips, threw back his head, and raised his free hand to balance himself. One of the footmen who had stooped to pick up some broken glass remained in that position without taking his eyes from the window and from Dolokhov's back. Anatole stood erect with staring eyes. The Englishman looked on sideways, pursing up his lips. The man who had wished to stop the affair ran to a corner of the room and threw himself on a sofa with his face to the wall. Pierre hid his face, from which a faint smile forgot to fade, though his features now expressed horror and fear. All was still. Pierre took his hands from his eyes. Dolokhov still sat in the same position, only his head was thrown further back till his curly hair touched his shirt collar and the hand holding the bottle was lifted higher and higher and trembled with the effort. The bottle was emptying perceptibly and rising still higher and his head tilting yet further back. "Why is it so long?" thought Pierre. It seemed to him that more than half an hour had elapsed. Suddenly, Dolokhov made a backward movement with his spine, and his arm trembled nervously. This was sufficient to cause his whole body to slip as he sat on the sloping ledge. As he began slipping down, his head and arm wavered still more with the strain. One hand moved as if to clutch the windowsill, but refrained from touching it. Pierre again covered his eyes and thought he would never open them again. Suddenly, he was aware of a stir all round. He looked up. Dolokhov was standing on the windowsill, with a pale but radiant face.
"It's empty!"
He threw the bottle to the Englishman, who caught it neatly. Dolokhov jumped down. He smelt strongly of rum.
"Well done, fine fellow! There's a bet for you! Devil take you!" came from different sides.
The Englishman took out his purse and began counting out the money. Dolokhov stood frowning and did not speak. Pierre jumped upon the windowsill.
"Gentlemen, who wishes to bet with me? I'll do the same thing," he suddenly cried, "even without a bet. There, tell them to bring me a bottle. I'll do it. Bring a bottle."
"Let him do it. Let him do it," said Dolokhov, smiling.
"What next? Have you gone mad? No one would let you. Why, you get giddy even on a staircase," exclaimed several voices. "I'll drink it. Let's have a bottle of rum," shouted Pierre, banging the table with a determined and drunken gesture and preparing to climb out of the window. They seized him by his arms, but he was so strong that everyone who touched him was sent flying.
"No, you'll never manage him that way," said Anatole. "Wait a bit and I'll get round him. Listen. I'll take your bet tomorrow, but now we're all going to what's-her-name's." "Come on, then," cried Pierre. "Come on, and we'll take Bruin with us." And he caught the bear, took it in his arms, lifted it from the ground, and began dancing round the room with it.
Chapter 10. A Name Day at the Rostovs. Prince Vasily kept the promise he had given to Princess Drubetskaya, who had spoken to him on behalf of her only son Boris on the evening of Anna Pavlovna's soiree. The matter was mentioned to the Emperor, an exception made, and Boris transferred to the regiment of Semyonov Guards, with the rank of cornet. He received, however, no appointment to Kutuzov's staff, despite all Anna Mikhailovna's endeavours and entreaties. Soon after Anna Pavlovna's reception, Anna Mikhailovna returned to Moscow and went straight to her rich relations, the Rostovs, with whom she stayed when in the town, and where her darling Borry, who had only just entered a regiment of the line and was being at once transferred to the guards as a cornet, had been educated from childhood and lived for years at a time. The guards had already left Petersburg on the 10th of August, and her son, who had remained in Moscow for his equipment, was to join them on the march to Radzivilov. It was St. Natalia's Day, and the name day of two of the Rostovs, the mother and the youngest daughter, both named Natalie. Ever since the morning, carriages with six horses had been coming and going continually, bringing visitors to the Countess Rostova's big house on the Povarskaya, so well known to all Moscow. The Countess herself and her handsome eldest daughter were in the drawing-room with the visitors who came to congratulate, and who constantly succeeded one another in relays. The Countess was a woman of about 45, with a thin, oriental type of face, evidently worn out with childbearing. She had had 12. A languor of motion and speech resulting from weakness gave her a distinguished air which inspired respect. Princess Anna Mikhailovna Drubetskaya, who as a member of the household was also seated in the drawing-room, helped to receive and entertain the visitors. The young people were in one of the inner rooms, not considering it necessary to take part in receiving the visitors. The Count met the guests and saw them off, inviting them all to dinner.
"I am very, very grateful to you, mon cher, or ma chère." He called everyone without exception and without the slightest variation in his tone, my dear, whether they were above or below him in rank. "I thank you for myself and for our two dear ones whose name day we are keeping. But mind you come to dinner, or I shall be offended, ma chère. On behalf of the whole family, I beg you to come, mon cher." These words he repeated to everyone without exception or variation, and with the same expression on his full, cheerful, clean-shaven face, the same firm pressure of the hand, and the same quick, repeated bows. As soon as he had seen a visitor off, he returned to one of those who were still in the drawing-room, drew a chair toward him or her, and jauntily spreading out his legs and putting his hands on his knees with the air of a man who enjoys life and knows how to live, he swayed to and fro with dignity, offered surmises about the weather, or touched on questions of health, sometimes in Russian and sometimes in very bad but self-confident French. Then again, like a man weary but unflinching in the fulfilment of duty, he rose to see some visitors off, and, stroking his scanty grey hairs over his bald patch, also asked them to dinner. Sometimes, on his way back from the anteroom, he would pass through the conservatory and pantry into the large marble dining-hall, where tables were being set out for 80 people, and looking at the footmen who were bringing in silver and china, moving tables and unfolding damask table linen, he would call Dmitri Vasilievich, a man of good family and the manager of all his affairs, and while looking with pleasure at the enormous table would say, "Well, Dmitri, you'll see that things are all as they should be. That's right. The great thing is the serving. That's it." And with a complacent sigh, he would return to the drawing-room.
"Marya Lvovna Karagina and her daughter," announced the Countess's gigantic footman in his bass voice, entering the drawing-room.
The Countess reflected a moment and took a pinch from a gold snuff-box with her husband's portrait on it.
"I am quite worn out by these callers, however. I'll see her and no more. She is so affected. Ask her in," she said to the footman in a sad voice, as if saying, "Very well, finish me off."
A tall, stout and proud-looking woman with a round-faced, smiling daughter entered the drawing-room, their dresses rustling.
"Dear Countess, what an age! She has been laid up, poor child. At the Razumovsky's ball, and Countess Apraxina, I was so delighted," came the sounds of animated feminine voices, interrupting one another and mingling with the rustling of dresses and the scraping of chairs.
Then one of those conversations began which last out until, at the first pause, the guests rise with a rustle of dresses and say,
"I'm so delighted, Mama's health, and Countess Apraxina,"
and then, again rustling, pass into the anteroom, put on cloaks or mantles, and drive away. The conversation was on the chief topic of the day, the illness of the wealthy and celebrated beau of Catherine's day, Count Bezúkhov, and about his illegitimate son Pierre, the one who had behaved so improperly at Anna Pavlovna's reception.
"I am so sorry for the poor Count," said the visitor. "He is in such bad health, and now this vexation about his son is enough to kill him."
"What is that?" asked the Countess, as if she did not know what the visitor alluded to, though she had already heard about the cause of Count Bezúkhov's distress some 15 times.
"That's what comes of modern education," exclaimed the visitor. "It seems that while he was abroad, this young man was allowed to do as he liked. Now, in Petersburg, I hear he has been doing such terrible things that he has been expelled by the police."
"You don't say so," replied the Countess. "He chose his friends badly," interposed Anna Mikhailovna. "Prince Vasily's son, he and a certain Dolokhov, have, it is said, been up to heaven only knows what. And they have had to suffer for it. Dolokhov has been degraded to the ranks, and Bezúkhov's son sent back to Moscow. Anatole Kuragin's father managed somehow to get his son's affair hushed up, but even he was ordered out of Petersburg."
"But what have they been up to?" asked the Countess.
"They are regular brigands, especially Dolokhov," replied the visitor. "He is a son of Maria Ivanovna Dolokhova. Such a worthy woman, but they're just fancy. Those three got hold of a bear somewhere, put it in a carriage, and set off with it to visit some actresses. The police tried to interfere, and what did the young men do? They tied a policeman and the bear back to back and put the bear into the Moika Canal, and there was the bear swimming about with the policeman on his back."
"What a nice figure the policeman must have cut, my dear!" shouted the Count, dying with laughter.
"Oh, how dreadful! How can you laugh at it, Count?"
Yet the ladies themselves could not help laughing.
"It was all they could do to rescue the poor man," continued the visitor. "And to think it is Cyril Vladimirovich Bezúkhov's son who amuses himself in this sensible manner. And he was said to be so well-educated and clever. This is all that his foreign education has done for him. I hope that here in Moscow no one will receive him in spite of his money. They wanted to introduce him to me, but I quite declined. I have my daughters to consider."
"Why do you say this young man is so rich?" asked the Countess, turning away from the girls, who at once assumed an air of inattention. "His children are all illegitimate. I think Pierre also is illegitimate." The visitor made a gesture with her hand.
"I should think he has a score of them."
Princess Anna Mikhailovna intervened in the conversation, evidently wishing to show her connections and knowledge of what went on in society.
"The fact of the matter is," she said significantly and also in a half whisper, "everyone knows Count Cyril's reputation. He has lost count of his children, but this Pierre was his favourite."
"How handsome the old man still was only a year ago," remarked the Countess. "I have never seen a handsomer man."
"He is very much altered now," said Anna Mikhailovna. "Well, as I was saying, Prince Vasily is the next heir through his wife, but the Count is very fond of Pierre, looked after his education, and wrote to the Emperor about him, so that in the case of his death, and he is so ill that he may die at any moment, and Dr. Lorrain has come from Petersburg, no one knows who will inherit his immense fortune, Pierre or Prince Vasily. 40,000 serfs and millions of rubles. I know it all very well, for Prince Vasily told me himself. Besides, Cyril Vladimirovich is my mother's second cousin.
He's also my body's godfather," she added, as if she attached no importance at all to the fact.
"Prince Vasily arrived in Moscow yesterday. I hear he has come on some inspection business," remarked the visitor.
Yes, but between ourselves, said the princess, that is a pretext. The fact is, he has come to see Count Cyril Vladimirovich, hearing how ill he is.
But you know, my dear, that was a capital joke, said the count,
and seeing that the elder visitor was not listening, he turned to the young ladies.
I can just imagine what a funny figure that policeman cut.
And as he waved his arms to impersonate the policeman, his portly form again shook with a deep, ringing laugh, the laugh of one who always eats well and, in particular, drinks well.
So do come and dine with us, he said.
Chapter 11. Natasha and Boris.
Silence ensued. The Countess looked at her callers, smiling affably, but not concealing the fact that she would not be distressed if they now rose and took their leave. The visitor's daughter was already smoothing down her dress with an inquiring look at her mother, when suddenly from the next room were heard the footsteps of boys and girls running to the door, and the noise of a chair falling over, and a girl of 13, hiding something in the folds of her short muslin frock, darted in and stopped short in the middle of the room. It was evident that she had not intended her flight to bring her so far. Behind her in the doorway appeared a student with a crimson coat collar, an officer of the guards, a girl of 15, and a plump, rosy-faced boy in a short jacket. The count jumped up and, swaying from side to side, spread his arms wide and threw them round the little girl who had run in.
"Ah, ha, 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 here she is!" he exclaimed, laughing. "My pet, whose name day it is, my dear pet!"
"Ma chère, there is a time for everything," said the Countess with feigned severity. "You spoil her, Ilya," she added, turning to her husband.
"How do you do, my dear? I wish you many happy returns of your name day," said the visitor.
"What a charming child," she added, addressing the mother.
This black-eyed, wide-mouthed girl, not pretty but full of life, with childish bare shoulders, which after her run heaved and shook her bodice, with black curls tossed backwards, thin bare arms, little legs in lace-frilled drawers and feet in low slippers, was just at that charming age when a girl is no longer a child, though the child is not yet a young woman. Escaping from her father, she ran to hide her flushed face in the lace of her mother's mantilla, not paying the least attention to her severe remark, and began to laugh. She laughed, and in fragmentary sentences, tried to explain about a doll which she produced from the folds of her frock.
"Do you see? My doll! Mimi, you see?" was all Natasha managed to utter. To her, everything seemed funny.
She leaned against her mother and burst into such a loud, ringing fit of laughter that even the prim visitor could not help joining in.
"Now then, go away and take your monstrosity with you," said the mother, pushing away her daughter with pretended sternness. And turning to the visitor, she added, "She is my youngest girl."
Natasha, raising her face for a moment from her mother's mantilla, glanced up at her through tears of laughter and again hid her face. The visitor, compelled to look on at this family scene, thought it necessary to take some part in it.
"Tell me, my dear," said she to Natasha, "is Mimi a relation of yours? A daughter, I suppose?"
Natasha did not like the visitor's tone of condescension to childish things. She did not reply, but looked at her seriously. Meanwhile, the younger generation, Boris, the officer, Anna Mikhailovna's son, Nikolai, the undergraduate, the Count's eldest son, Sonia, the Count's 15-year-old niece, and little Petya, his youngest boy, had all settled down in the drawing-room and were obviously trying to restrain within the bounds of decorum the excitement and mirth that shone in all their faces. Evidently, in the back rooms from which they had dashed out so impetuously, the conversation had been more amusing than the drawing-room talk of society scandals, the weather, and Countess Apraxina. Now and then they glanced at one another, hardly able to suppress their laughter. The two young men, the student and the officer, friends from childhood, were of the same age and both handsome fellows, though not alike. Boris was tall and fair, and his calm and handsome face had regular, delicate features. Nikolai was short, with curly hair and an open expression. Dark hairs were already showing on his upper lip, and his whole face expressed impetuosity and enthusiasm. Nikolai blushed when he entered the drawing-room. He evidently tried to find something to say, but failed. Boris, on the contrary, at once found his footing, and related quietly and humorously how he had known that doll, Mimi, when she was still quite a young lady, before her nose was broken, how she had aged during the 5 years he had known her, and how her head had cracked right across the skull. Having said this, he glanced at Natasha. She turned away from him and glanced at her younger brother, who was screwing up his eyes and shaking with suppressed laughter, and unable to control herself any longer, she jumped up and rushed from the room as fast as her nimble little feet would carry her. Boris did not laugh. "You were meaning to go out, weren't you, Mama? Do you want the carriage?" he asked his mother with a smile.
"Yes, yes. Go and tell them to get it ready," she answered, returning his smile.
Boris quietly left the room and went in search of Natasha. The plump boy ran after them angrily, as if vexed that their programme had been disturbed. Chapter 12. The only young people remaining in the drawing-room, not counting the young lady visitor and the Countess's eldest daughter, who was 4 years older than her sister and behaved already like a grown-up person, were Nikolai and Sonia, the niece. Sonia was a slender little brunette, with a tender look in her eyes which were veiled by long lashes, thick black plaits coiling twice round her head, and a tawny tint in her complexion, and especially in the colour of her slender but graceful and muscular arms and neck. By the grace of her movements, by the softness and flexibility of her small limbs, and by a certain coyness and reserve of manner, she reminded one of a pretty, half-grown kitten which promises to become a beautiful little cat. She evidently considered it proper to show an interest in the general conversation by smiling, but in spite of herself, her eyes under their thick, long lashes watched her cousin who was going to join the army with such passionate, girlish adoration that her smile could not for a single instant impose upon anyone, and it was clear that the kitten had settled down only to spring up with more energy and again play with her cousin as soon as they too could, like Natasha and Boris, escape from the drawing-room.
"Ah, yes, my dear," said the Count, addressing the visitor and pointing to Nikolai. "His friend Boris has become an officer, and so, for friendship's sake, he is leaving the university, and me, his old father, and entering the military service, my dear. And there was a place and everything waiting for him in the archives department. Isn't that friendship?"
remarked the Count in an inquiring tone.
"But they say that war has been declared," replied the visitor. "They've been saying so a long while," said the Count, "and they'll say so again and again, and that'll be the end of it. My dear, there's friendship for you," he repeated. "He's joining the Hussars."
The visitor, not knowing what to say, shook her head.
"It's not at all from friendship," declared Nikolai, flaring up, and turning away as if from a shameful aspersion. "It's not from friendship at all. I simply feel that the army is my vocation."
He glanced at his cousin and the young lady visitor, and they were both regarding him with a smile of approbation.
"Schubert, the colonel of the Pavlograd Hussars, is dining with us today. He's been here on leave and is taking Nikolai back with him." "It can't be helped," said the Count, shrugging his shoulders and speaking playfully of a matter that evidently distressed him.
"I've already told you, Papa," said his son, "that if you don't wish to let me go, I'll stay. But I know I'm no use anywhere except in the army. I'm not a diplomat or a government clerk. I don't know how to hide what I feel."
As he spoke, he kept glancing with the flirtatiousness of a handsome youth at Sonia and the young lady visitor.
The little kitten, feasting her eyes on him, seemed ready at any moment to start her gambols again and display her kittenish nature.
"All right, all right," said the old Count. "He always flares up. This Buonaparte has turned all their heads. They all think of how he rose from an ensign and became emperor. Well, well, God grant it," he added, not noticing his visitor's sarcastic smile.
The elders began talking about Buonaparte. Julie Karagina turned to young Rostov.
"What a pity you weren't at the Arkharovs on Thursday. It was so dull without you," said she, giving him a tender smile.
The young man, flattered, sat down nearer to her with a coquettish smile and engaged the smiling Julie in a confidential conversation, without at all noticing that his involuntary smile had stabbed the heart of Sonya, who blushed and smiled unnaturally. In the midst of his talk he glanced round at her. She gave him a passionately angry glance, and hardly able to restrain her tears and maintain the artificial smile on her lips, she got up and left the room. All Nikolai's animation vanished. He waited for the first pause in the conversation, and then, with a distressed face, left the room to find Sonya.
"How plainly all these young people wear their hearts on their sleeves," said Anna Mikhailovna, pointing to Nikolai as he went out. "Cousinage, dangereux voisinage," she added. "Yes," said the Countess, when the brightness these young people had brought into the room had vanished, and as if answering a question no one had put, but which was always in her mind, "and how much suffering, how much anxiety one has had to go through that we might rejoice in them now. And yet really the anxiety is greater now than the joy. One is always, always anxious, especially just at this age, so dangerous both for girls and boys."
"It all depends on the bringing up," remarked the visitor.
"Yes, you're quite right," continued the Countess. "Till now I have always, thank God, been my children's friend and had their full confidence," said she, repeating the mistake of so many parents who imagine that their children have no secrets from them. "I know I shall always be my daughter's first confidante, and that if Nikolai, with his impulsive nature, does get into mischief, a boy can't help it, he will all the same never be like those Petersburg young men."
"Yes, they are splendid, splendid youngsters," chimed in the Count, who always solved questions that seemed to him perplexing by deciding that everything was splendid. "Just fancy, wants to be in a czar. What's one to do, my dear?"
"What a charming creature your younger girl is," said the visitor. "A little volcano."
"Yes, a regular volcano," said the Count. "Takes after me. And what a voice she has. Though she's my daughter, I tell the truth when I say she'll be a singer, a second Salamone. We have engaged an Italian to give her lessons."
"Isn't she too young? I have heard that it harms the voice to train it at that age."
"Oh, no, not at all too young," replied the Count. "Why, our mothers used to be married at 12 or 13.
"And she's in love with Boris already, just fancy," said the Countess with a gentle smile, looking at Boris's mother, and went on, evidently concerned with a thought that always occupied her. "Now, you see, if I were to be severe with her and to forbid it, goodness knows what they might be up to on the sly." She meant that they would be kissing. "But as it is, I know every word she utters. She will come running to me of her own accord in the evening and tell me everything. Perhaps I spoil her, but really that seems the best plan. With her elder sister I was stricter."
"Yes, I was brought up quite differently," remarked the handsome elder daughter, Countess Vera, with a smile.
But the smile did not enhance Vera's beauty as smiles generally do. On the contrary, it gave her an unnatural and therefore unpleasant expression. Vera was good-looking, not at all stupid, quick at learning, was well brought up, and had a pleasant voice. What she said was true and appropriate, yet, strange to say, everyone,
the visitors and countess alike turned to look at her as if wondering why she had said it, and they all felt awkward.
"People are always too clever with their eldest children and try to make something exceptional of them," said the visitor.
"What's the good of denying it, my dear? Our dear countess was too clever with Vera," said the count. "Well, what of that? She's turned out splendidly all the same," he added, winking at Vera.
The guests got up and took their leave, promising to return to dinner.
"What manners! I thought they would never go," said the countess when she had seen her guests out.
Chapter 13.
When Natasha ran out of the drawing room, she only went as far as the conservatory. There she paused and stood listening to the conversation.